Two and a Half Admins, episode 243. I'm Joe.
I'm Jim.
And I'm Alan.
And here we are again. And before we get started, your article plug, Alan, is accurate and effective storage benchmarking.
Yeah, and so this article, we cover how to align your benchmarks with your real-world usage, whether that's a database server or an analytics systems or a media editing workload or whatever, why you need to test under the worst-case scenario and why that number is more useful to you than just the best case scenario or just any one benchmark, how to verify the results and make sure that you're not getting weird side effects, and then how to ensure you get repeatable benchmarks, controlling the environment, A/B testing all your modifications, and ensuring just consistency when you're performing tests.
Right, well, link in the show notes as usual. Your IPv4 stash can now be collateral for $100 million loans. I knew that IPv4 addresses were valuable, but not quite this valuable.
Well, it typically will cost you around $50 a year to have temporary use of a public IP address. So you put together a few thousand of them, that's a lot of capital.
Yeah, so this started with Cogent, which is one of the backbone transit providers, issuing notes, which are basically like a kind of bond that are basically secured by a block of IP addresses. So they basically managed to borrow $206 million over the course of 5 years, or 4 or 5 years, from not the stock market, but effectively by securing it against their IP addresses. So if they don't pay back the $206 million plus the interest, I think at 5.something% over the course of that 5 years, then the people who hold the note would get access to those IP addresses, would take ownership of those IP addresses. So basically they're mortgaging the IP addresses effectively. And so this other company, IPv4.global, which is basically a marketplace where you can go to buy and sell IP addresses, usually in blocks, not individual IP addresses, is saying, you know, we're owned by a company that does this kind of financing stuff. So we'd be willing to lend you up to $100 million if you sign over your IP addresses to us, basically. And they say there'd be limits where they would only lend out so much, because they know that if a bunch of people defaulted at once and they had all these IP addresses, they wouldn't be able to sell them for enough money or quickly enough to actually get their money back. So this isn't everybody can come and get $100 million for their IP addresses, but people with, that are a good credit risk and so on, that they're willing to put up a bunch of money against those IPv4 addresses because they consider them that valuable and that they'll probably only be worth more in the future.
Assuming that you're correct about the reason for the limits, and the thought process is that if they get too many of these IPv4 addresses on their hands, they won't be able to turn around quick enough for enough money. That's refreshingly short-sighted. I, for one, am kind of tired of large businesses taking the opposite approach and thinking, what if I just buy all of this thing and then I can set whatever ridiculous price I would like to for it? So it's kind of nice to think they would prefer not to own the entire global stock of available IPv4 addresses.
Well, I think in this case, they just can't sell them quickly enough to get, you know, to pay off their loan for hundreds of millions of dollars.
And again, it's kind of refreshing to see a large business thinking in those terms rather than in, we have the capital, we'll acquire all the thing and then bend everybody over the barrel. The other interesting thing about that to me is it's pretty obvious that IPv4 addresses are very valuable. Like I said, it's usually going to cost you about $50 an IP address to rent one for a year. If you're, quote, buying, unquote, IPv4 addresses by the subnet, you can usually get a rate of around $30 an IP address, depending on how large of a subnet that you're buying. So obviously, that is a very lucrative thing to hold, despite it being, you know, intangible and immaterial. So it doesn't surprise me that you could secure a huge loan with a whole bunch of IP addresses. The more interesting thing is that this signifies that not only are IPv4 addresses valuable right now, but this company is willing to bet that they're staying valuable for a while. So in theory, we could just all be using IPv6 tomorrow and there would be no more IP address scarcity because there would be more than millions of them for every single person on the planet. We wouldn't be able to put enough humans on planet Earth and give them enough devices to exhaust the IPv6 address space. So the fact that a company is willing to offer $100 million loans for IPv4 addresses is significant in that it means that company in its position to be able to see a lot of trends at, you know, a higher level than most of us can, thinks that IPv4 is not going anywhere anytime soon.
Yeah, like to your point, actually, in the kind of more context section on the Register's article here, there's a link to a story about how Huawei secured an IPv6 allocation with 10 commas in the number for how many IP addresses that is. Does anybody want to give me a loan against my IPv6 addresses? It's mostly interesting seeing that, you know, first of all, the fact that this IPv4 marketplace is owned by a financial services company called Hilco Global that deals with this kind of financializing things that are normally not really considered collateral. Apparently, they make a whole business out of building these kind of secondary markets for things like that. But that, you know, they say, if there is a default, we'll be able to control the monetization of our collateral and basically turn it around quickly enough that they can pay off whoever they're loaning the money from or please their investors with it quickly enough.
I think that the only reason that feels surprising, Alan, is because you and I both, you know, grew up with the dawn of the internet. And so we had a long time to get accustomed to the idea that, like, you know, the big stuffy money old guys like don't get the internet or get how valuable, you know, it could be. Ha ha, let's laugh at these stuffy old dudes. But mainstream internet access is 30 years old this year. I would say that the mainstream internet access happened in 1995 with the advent of Windows 95. That's when I really saw like everybody and their brother, whether they're on Win 95 or not, that's when everybody started getting AOL accounts. That was the September that never ended. And 30 years is enough time for even the old stuffy dumb guys in suits to figure out when something's valuable. So we really should not be expecting at this point that, you know, banks and financial institutions don't see the entire value of an asset like an IPv4 subnet. And they might understand it better than we do at this point, because we understand the money as a side effect of understanding the thing, whereas they want to understand the money first and foremost, and now they've had 3 decades to do it.
Congress close to passing deepfake law. Trump said he wants to use it himself.
This is one of those things where coming from somebody else, it might seem like a good idea. And it's one of those bills that's very difficult to fight because it sounds like such a good idea. Yeah, who wants it to be legal to make deepfake porn of some innocent person and then post it online? That's a terrible thing. You shouldn't be able to do that. The problem is that, you know, much like FOSTA and SESTA, this is one of those feel-good laws that doesn't look like it's poised to actually accomplish much good and can be abused for a lot of bad reasons. And when you get someone like our president, whether you like Trump or not, when you get someone like Trump who says he is eager to use a tool against people, that's a sign that it's probably going to get misused quite a lot. And that person sees a lot of potential for misuse. The other thing I think that's worth noting is that there have been some suggested amendments to limit the scope of the bill to make it less useful as just a broad hammer to hit anybody with that you don't like who has less money to fight it with than you do. And those proposed amendments keep getting shot down with great verve by exactly who you would expect to.
And as with all of the laws like this, it's the kind of the double-edged sword of how do they make it have enough teeth that people will actually take things down, but find ways to prevent people from abusing it. As we've seen with the DMCA and takedown notices, even if you just use only YouTube as an example, most things end up getting pulled down too easily, and it's a big fight to get things back up. And this is just going to make that worse because, say, online platforms have only 48 hours to remove anything when they receive, quote, a valid removal request from an identifiable individual or a authorized person acting on behalf of such an individual. No way of mentioning what an unidentifiable individual is. It seems what they're trying to say is one of the people in the deepfake, but it is not clear that that's actually what they mean or what it will be interpreted as.
This bill is absolutely littered with, I think, deliberate imprecision like this. Like it talks about deepfake images of intimate situations, and it doesn't go on to define what that means. Well, that's a problem when you use a word like intimate. You think, oh, well, I know what that means. Well, that's great that you think you know what that means. But let me tell you what it actually means. What it actually means is it's a word without a well-known legal definition that is not separately defined within the text of the bill in a way that is actually precise, which means that this law gets used for absolutely freaking everything. And if you don't like an obvious misuse of the law, you'd better have the resources to fight it in court, because you're going to have to go fight it in court, because it's not obvious that whatever this thing was doesn't count as intimate. Was it intimate when whoever posted all those deepfake videos of Trump sucking on Musk's toes? I don't know. Maybe. You could argue that it is, but is that what the intent was? Is something like that sufficient? Or, you know, should this only be for something, you know, more hardcore sexual, something that only involves nudity? I'm not saying I know the answers to that. I'm saying that the authors of the bill didn't even attempt to solve this. They are just dropping this turd into Congress and hoping to get it passed. And then the courts will have to try to narrow it down later. And, you know, then you have this situation where even once the courts start narrowing it down, now instead of having a bill that you can read and you can see what it refers to and it's clearly defined, now you've got, you know, years and years of case law and precedent you have to wade through. And you have to say, okay, well, when this judge said that that judge interpreted it this way, that sets a precedent and the courts are supposed to follow a precedent that's been set, but also they don't have to follow a precedent that's been set. And so is this precedent going to stick? Do I have to follow this one? Can I suggest we should set a different precedent now? Who knows? Let's spend $100,000 and find out every single time.
Also, you only have 48 hours to make the decision. So good luck consulting a lawyer about each one of these removal requests to decide if it's one way or another. And that's where you end up with this chilling effect of, well, we're just going to remove everything that gets reported and maybe we'll put it back if the original poster complains about it or something, because we're not going to risk being on the wrong side of it. And even in the press where they're trying to trumpet this thing, they use terms like no man, woman, or child should be subject to the spread of explicit AI images. It's like, okay, explicit is maybe more exact than intimate, but it's also still lacks that specific definition, right? As is always the joke, you know, porn isn't defined, but you'll know it when you see it. And it's like that doesn't help anybody on the site side decide what should and shouldn't be removed, let alone on the judicial side.
And this imposition potentially goes both ways. I mean, so I brought up the example of the deepfake video that was strewn through, I forget which government building. It took them a while and they had to go unplug stuff because all the TVs were showing this deep fake of Trump sucking Musk's toes. And you could argue that that's not intimate because there's no nudity. And you could argue that it's not a sexual act. Although you could also argue, obviously, that it is a sexual act or it's intended to be interpreted that way. But it goes both ways. Let's say instead that it was a deep fake nude of somebody taking a shower and like they weren't doing anything sexual. They were just washing themselves. Is that intimate or is it not? What if it's not a shower? What if they're just walking down a hall and they're not clothed? Is that intimate? I don't know. Is it explicit? Don't know that either. In pornography, that would not be termed explicit because there's not an actual sexual act happening on camera. That would be referred to as softcore. So it just, none of this stuff is defined. And in a court, in the middle of a lawsuit, is not the right place to define things like this.
I knew this law was going to be bad when I saw the name and realized the reason it was such a tortured name is because they backronymed it. Although backronym is not the right word because they didn't turn it into an acronym. But the short name for the law is the Take It Down Act. And so the actual name is, quote, Tools to Address Known Exploitation by Immobilizing Technological Deepfakes on Websites and Networks Act.
I did a lot of that kind of thing in like fourth, fifth, and sixth grade. I thought it was real clever.
You know, so much open source and network protocol stuff is the same kind of idea, but that one is just extra tortured. And I don't know, the government probably employs a couple of people who just come up with names for acts like this, and they're awfully damn good at it. But it's just like, oh my God.
I don't know. Ted Cruz might have come up with that one himself.
That was the second signal that this law was probably not very good.
Okay, this episode is sponsored by people who support us with PayPal and Patreon. Go to 2.5admins.com/support for details of how you can support us too. Patreon supporters have the option to listen to episodes without ads like this. And it's not just this show. There's Late Night Linux for news, discoveries, audience input, and misanthropy. Linux Matters for upbeat family-friendly adventures. Linux After Dark for silly challenges and philosophical debates. Linux Dev Time about developing with and for Linux. Hybrid Cloud Show for everything public and private cloud. And ask the hosts for off-topic questions from you. You can even get some episodes a bit early. We've got a lot going on, and it's only possible because of the people who support us. So if you like what we do and can afford it, it would be great if you could support us too at 2.5admins.com/support. Microsoft is 50 years old. To mark the event, they had some AI bullshit conference thing. Don't really care about that, but it's quite the milestone, I think, for one of the huge tech giants to be 50 years old.
It is. And I think Microsoft has probably managed it with less in the way of drastic reinvention of itself than IBM had by its 50-year milestone. Once you start talking about these companies that have been around for half a century, the field really narrows way down, and you start to be able to do some pretty interesting comparisons and contrasts. And again, I think Microsoft and IBM is one of the big ones because they are similar in a lot of ways, but they're also very, very different. Obviously, IBM started out in the hardware game and went through two or three different flavors of hardware before they got out of the hardware game and eventually wound up where they are now, which is consulting more than anything else. Microsoft, though, has stayed pretty true to its roots. I mean, it very much started out as a software development and, you know, very quickly operating system development company. It's flirted with hardware over the years. It's flirted with a lot of things. It's added, you know, gaming to its repertoire, mostly by acquiring studios, but nevertheless, it manages them. You know, it's not just like a silent investor, but it's also still, you know, the software and operating system vendor, essentially in the same way that it was 50 years ago, just on a much, much larger scale and obviously with a lot more market share.
I think they make quite a lot of money out of Xbox, don't they?
I did say gaming, didn't I?
Yeah, but like hardware specifically there, like
the hardware is a loss leader.
Yep.
Yeah. What they're doing there is the operating system and licensing for the games.
Yeah. So again, no, not so much with the hardware company. They flirt with it, and when necessary, they'll build hardware to facilitate the sales of something. I hate to say I can imagine a future in which Microsoft starts making more in the way of like actual PCs. And if they're allowed to develop much market share in that fashion, you know, more than they got, like, for example, with the Surface line, I think that has really bad implications for closing off the Windows ecosystem to the point where, you know, you're stuck with Microsoft hardware the same way you're stuck with Apple hardware if you want to run macOS. And I think that would suck.
Yeah, I think that was only unthinkable in the past when third-party software was such a big deal. But nowadays, almost all third-party software is delivered via the web or something and isn't, you know, how many people are paying for desktop apps on a you buy it on a CD mechanism. So in the past, becoming the hardware vendor and kind of locking it down a la Apple would have been against Microsoft's interest because a big part of their business was just the fact that Microsoft is where you got this big suite of all this third-party software. But now almost all that stuff is SaaS, software as a service, and is available on whatever machine you have. And so Microsoft doesn't have the disincentive not to lock down hardware and do things. And we've seen with, you know, Windows 11 and going on, they're like, oh, well, we're going to require that you have secure boot and TPMs, and we're going to keep ratcheting things up until, yeah, maybe you get to the point where it's no longer in their interest to work with companies like Lenovo and Dell and so on to sell you a laptop. They will just have their own thing, like they started to see with the Copilot-based ones with the Qualcomm chips.
Mm-hmm. I don't think we're very far away from that at all either. And it's worth pointing out, you know, you mentioned correctly, like, you know, who's installing local apps anymore? You know, everybody's, you know, delivering, you know, software, you know, in browser. And the flip side of that coin that you didn't mention is there's getting to be less and less point to running the native local apps, not simply because what's in the browser performs well enough, because the operating system vendors are starting to restrict access to low-level resources and APIs and not grant it to third-party software developers at all. For example, macOS right now, if you want an iSCSI initiator on your macOS machine, tough shit, you can't have one because the API that you need in order to get kernel access to make a performant iSCSI initiator, Apple won't give you. You can't have it. So there used to be several open source iSCSI initiators available for macOS, but after a change they made in 2021, they no longer have access to the kernel APIs they would need for that. So these open source projects and several commercial projects that did the same thing have just folded, and they now have we're dead now web pages up, letting you know that if you still happen to be running, you know, like a 6-year-old version of macOS, sure, you can download their legacy discontinued product and it will work. But on the new one, not only can you not have it, it ain't coming because Apple won't grant access. So it's not only that the browser is a convenient way to access software, you know, versus locally installed software. It's not only that it might perform well enough to compete directly, it's also a situation of increasingly the whoever is controlling the operating system isn't going to let you have enough low-level access to your actual local hardware resources to make local software any more compelling than something that you're doing through a browser.
I do think about my friends running studios and stuff, and granted that's on Macs, but they are still very much using locally installed software. Yeah, they're paying per month for it, but it's not in the browser. And I think about an architect friend that I know who is using CAD software.
Mm-hmm. Especially in the media and entertainment space. At Clara, we build giant storage arrays for companies that are like animation studios or color correction studios or, you know, everything around Hollywood and TV shows and so on. And yeah, all of that is still desktop software, although a lot of it is starting to be Linux now, which is nice. Other than NFS on Linux is not as good as it should be.
Linux is nice. Alan said it.
No, I said NFS on Linux blows compared to BSD, but that's...
Yeah, but you said people using Linux is nice. I think we're going to clip that one.
Well, it's better than them using Windows, I would agree, yes.
It's nice for FreeBSD to have something to hang its hat on compared to Linux. So we'll let you have this one, Alan.
All right, then. Officially. But yeah, so I don't think desktop software is entirely dead. And to Joe's point, you know, there are still some things that the bandwidth levels, like video editing, are just never going to be something you can do entirely in the browser outside of toy stuff like YouTube.
I agree, but the ugly potential future there is that those folks who actually desperately need that low-level access, well, your operating system vendor may just decide that's not a big enough market to bother with because we like the advantages of closing everything off, so the hell with them. Or they may decide, you know what? We're going to have, you know, Windows Studio now. So if you want access to that thing that you'll need for your thing, well, now you need to pay us $10,000 a seat because we know you're making money with this crap. And if you're not making money with it, well, then why do we care about you? Because you're not making money for us. So whatever.
And you've talked about in the past, I can't remember what show it was on, Jim, maybe this show, the idea of appliances going back to that old thing of like, say you want to do video editing, you have to buy the video editing appliance. You don't just buy the software and run it on a general purpose computer.
Absolutely. And we're already starting to see signs of that kind of thing. And basically just when you see a formerly wide open industry that usually revolved around published specifications and anybody can build one of these things that will interoperate with other things, and you see that industry flower based on that. I mean, I don't know how many of our listeners are old enough to remember the explosion of the IBM PC compatible when the IBM PC architecture got opened up and anybody could make a clone that was as good as IBM's own stuff. Like, the impact on the computer industry was huge. I mean, we didn't really have a PC industry in the sense that we have one now until IBM opened up that platform. And that just made everything completely blow up. When you see that same industry start saying, you know what, we see the advantages of tight vertical silos and, you know, making everybody do exactly the thing that we want to do. And, you know, openness just gives somebody else an opportunity. And we're not in the business of giving other people opportunities. That's really worrying because I've lived through those periods when that was the operating principle and I didn't like it and I don't want to go back.
Well, and this is actually where my head was heading when we were discussing this is, you know, we've seen Apple start doing their own chips and Microsoft started flirting with Copilot and Qualcomm and ARM chips. If we get to the point where Microsoft also starts making their own chip, which they're already doing for their cloud servers, then pretty soon we end up with things more like a Chromebook than a laptop, where it is an appliance for running Microsoft OS and nothing else, right? It is just a terminal.
Well, yeah, that's why we've got the Steam Deck and Steam OS, is because Valve were very worried that Microsoft would basically lock down the OS to the point where the only way to install software was through their official store. That didn't happen, and it hasn't happened yet, but they wouldn't have made the Steam Deck if they weren't worried about that.
One might have argued that it didn't happen precisely because Valve proved you do not have a monopoly on gaming.
Mm.
If instead Valve had just thrown up its hands and been like, well, that's too hard. Gaming on Linux isn't going to sell. We could be looking at a very different situation right now. I don't think it's fair to just say that, oh, well, that didn't happen. So, you know, Valve was wrong about that, but, you know, whatever. Like, I don't think so. I think they were quite prescient, and I think they did the entire industry a huge solid by putting in all of that development and all of that investment into making certain that Linux was, in fact, a viable competitor as a gaming platform to Windows.
Let's do some free consulting then. But first, just a quick thank you to everyone who supports us with PayPal and Patreon. We really do appreciate that. And if you want to send any questions for Jim and Alan or your feedback, you can email show@2.5admins.com. Another perk of being a patron is you get to skip the queue, which is what Devon has done. They write, "My question is regarding antivirus and malware scanning. Jim has spoken vaguely in the past about disliking ClamAV. I wanted to know why. Does he use any alternative tools for scanning for infections? I will often use a live Linux environment to have a safe space for looking for infections on a Windows disk or machine, search with ClamAV, and then feed detected malware into Jotty. Additionally, I want to say both Jim and Alan have mentioned that Windows Defender is sufficient for Windows AV these days and is as good, if not better, than AV tools you get from a third party. However, would either of them recommend Defender for a small business? Or are there any centralized or IT-managed AV tools they'd recommend? Specifically, in a non-virtualized environment where the possibility of VMs with snapshots and immediate rollbacks is not feasible."
Devon is correct. I do not like ClamAV. Sometimes I've been vague, sometimes I've been less than vague about it, but here are the major reasons why. ClamAV is a massive resource hog, even more so than I would generally expect from an antivirus scanner, and the bar is pretty low. But more importantly, the thing that made me permanently done with ClamAV, I put up with it with the very low detection rate, which it's notorious for. I put up with the very high resource use, which it's also notorious for. But I was done with it forever when the developers, and now to be fair, this is more than a decade ago at this point, I had a really ugly day when I discovered at the end of the day that I had not been receiving email all day long. And the reason I had not been receiving email all day long is the developers of ClamAV decided to force everybody to upgrade their version of ClamAV by deliberately crafting an antivirus library definition file that would crash the current version. And so they crashed the daemon on my mail server, and I had my mail server configured not to accept new mail if virus scanning wasn't available. So I just didn't receive any more mail that day. And at the end of that day, I changed that configuration, and then I thought about it, and I just removed the ClamAV scanning entirely, because in probably 8 years of running ClamAV side by side with Spam Assassin on my mail filters, I never, ever once saw a valid detection from ClamAV that Spam Assassin had not already said no to.
Yeah, like I'm thinking now, I've never run ClamAV on my mail server, and I don't think I've ever got an executable as an attachment.
ClamAV can certainly detect things that are not just executables. I mean, it's a signature-based scanner, and it'll find whatever people have uploaded signatures, you know, for to its database. But again, the detection rate is abysmal. Out of valid detections, I would say Clam picked maybe one up for every 20 that Spam Assassin already got, despite Spam Assassin not even actually being an antivirus agent. I put up with it as like a belt and suspenders thing for a long time. But when it crashed that day and I started reading the news and discovered that it had very deliberately been crashed by the developers, I was just like, yeah, that is not something that I want on a system of mine. Like, if that's the thought process that the people developing this thing have, that it's cool for them to just deliberately force this daemon to crash as a way to get people's attention, I'm just like, no, I don't want any of your software on any of my systems.
To the second point of Devin's question, yes, I think I would agree that both Jim and I have said that Windows Defender is sufficient for your Windows antivirus. It's going to be probably at least as good, if not slightly better, than anything you're going to pay money for. And why are you going to pay money for things? Especially looking at the antivirus industry, almost every antivirus you've heard of is now owned by one company who is just bilking the money out of people who are still paying for an antivirus because they don't realize that Windows Defender is already doing as least as good a job as those antiviruses are. If you really look into the what makes up most antivirus software now, most of it is very outdated versions of open source tools like LibMagic. And if you've ever looked at LibMagic, you know, looking at arbitrary files and trying to determine what type they are is a recipe for C memory management bugs. And so most of those virus scanners may actually be making you less safe rather than more. And so just Windows Defender is probably as much as is going to make a difference either way. Either the threat actor is going to be using something no one's ever seen before and no antivirus is going to help you, or it is something run-of-the-mill that is already going to be in the Windows Defender definitions.
A lot of the ways that the third-party vendors try to differentiate themselves is they say that they've got these advanced heuristic algorithms that will detect malware that they don't actually have signatures for yet. And it's not entirely lies. They do build advanced heuristics into those things. The problem is they suck. You can be advanced and not be good at what you do. And in my experience, those heuristics eat a huge amount of additional processing cycles, generate a lot more false positives, and don't really catch anything legitimately that Defender would not have gotten. As far as, you know, following up the rest of the question, like, would I recommend Defender for a small business? Absolutely. It's what I use in the vast majority of my business clients. Love it. Now, if you require centralized management, you know, that's the one thing that the free version of Defender, you know, isn't going to offer you. Now, I do question how useful that truly is in most circumstances, because you can require Defender to be on by group policy and Active Directory. And if you've required it to be on, it's going to get automatically updated whether the user likes it or not. It doesn't require any kind of user intervention. So I'm not real sure what you're getting out of AV-specific centralized management. But if it's something that you really, really want, well, then I would recommend that you look into Microsoft Defender for Business, which the basic version of that for up to 300 seats costs you $3 per user per month paid annually, which is still a lot less expensive than most third-party antivirus. You know, even the home user antivirus, let alone the centrally managed business grade stuff. And if you've got more than 300 seats or you want some, you know, add-on features like 365 Copilot and, you know, blah, 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 blah. Well, then you can look at Microsoft 365 Business Premium, which is $22 per user per month paid annually and includes a lot more than just Defender. You actually get the Microsoft 365 stuff along with it. You want to look into that plan. Please don't think Jim told me everything I need to know about Microsoft 365 Business Premium and Defender. I have not. I've just told you it exists. And if you're interested in that, go look it up.
Yeah, and if it's a case where, you know, this business needs something beyond basically a desktop antivirus, you're probably not looking at antivirus so much as intrusion detection and network monitoring and so on, where you're looking at something more like CrowdStrike. I'd not necessarily recommend CrowdStrike in particular, but that genre of product.
Right, well, we better get out of here then. Remember, show@2.5admins.com if you want to send any questions or your feedback. You can find me at joelrest.com/mastodon.
You can find me at mercenarysysadmin.com.
And I'm at Alan Jude.
We'll see you next week.